All right, everyone, it's the Grim Lord here, and I'm back with another video. This is the Grim Articles Show, and it's just me and Zexy here, laying in the bed, of course. But I removed the sleep mask, so I guess you can at least see what's going on rather than just, you know, here. Anyway, let's go ahead and start with this article from ZDNet.com. It says, Google has created a time crystal in a quantum computer, and it's weirder than you can imagine. In a new research paper, Google scientists claim to have used a quantum processor for a useful scientific application to observe a genuine time crystal. If time crystals sounds pretty sci-fi, that's because they are. Time crystals are no less than a new phase of matter, as researchers put it, but which has been theorized for some years now as a new state that could possibly join the ranks of solids, liquids, gases, crystals, and so on. The paper remains in print, and still requires peer review. Time crystals are also hard to find, but Google scientists now rather excitingly say that their results establish a scalable approach to study time crystals on current quantum processors. Understanding why time crystals are interesting requires a little bit of background in physics, particularly in the second law of thermodynamics, which states that systems naturally tend to settle in a state known as maximum entropy. For example, if you pour some milk into a coffee cup, the milk will eventually dissolve throughout the coffee, instead of sitting on the top, enabling the overall system to come to an equilibrium. This is because there are many more ways for the coffee to randomly spread throughout... For the coffee to randomly spread throughout the coffee than there are for it to sit in a more orderly fashion at the top of the cup. The irresistible drive towards thermal equilibrium, as described in the second law of thermodynamics, is reflective of the fact that all things tend to move towards less useful random states. As time goes on, systems inevitably degenerate into chaos and disorder. That is entropy. I do believe that. Time crystals, on the other hand, fail to settle in thermal equilibrium. Instead of slowly degenerating towards randomness, they get stuck in two high energy configurations that they switch between, and this back and forth process can go on forever. To explain this better, Kurt von Kaiserlich, lecturer at the School of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Birmingham, who did not participate in Google's latest experiment, pulls out some slides from an introductory talk to prospective undergraduate students. They usually pretend to understand, so it might be useful, he warns ZDNet. It starts with a thought experiment. Take a box in a closed system that is isolated from the rest of the universe. Load it up with a couple of dozens of coins and shake it up a million times. As the coins flip, tumble, and bounce off each other, they randomly move positions and increasingly become more chaotic. Upon opening the box, the explanation is that you would be faced with roughly half the coins on either head side and half on their tails. It doesn't matter if the experiment started with more coins on their tails or more coins on their heads, the system forgets what the initial configuration was and it becomes increasingly random and chaotic as it is shaken. Wow, that's a good metaphor for current society. This closed system, when it is translated into the quantum domain, is the perfect setting to try and find time crystals, and only one known to date. Wow, they only know of one of these to date. The only stable time crystals that we've envisioned in closed systems are quantum mechanical, he says. Enter Google's quantum processor, Sycamore, which is well known for having achieved quantum supremacy and is now looking for some kind of useful application for quantum computing. A quantum processor, by definition, is a perfect tool to replicate a quantum mechanical system. In this scenario, Google's team represented the coins in the box with the qubits spinning upwards and downwards in a closed system, and instead of shaking the box, they applied a set of specific quantum organizations that can change the state of the qubits, which they've repeated many times. This is where time crystals defy all explanations. Looking at the system after a certain number of operations or shakes reveals a configuration of qubits that is not random, but instead looks rather similar to the original setup. The first ingredient that makes up a time crystal is that it remembers what it was doing initially. Initially, it doesn't forget, he says. The coins in a box system forgets, but a time crystal system doesn't. It doesn't stop here. Shake the system an even number of times, you'll get a similar configuration to the original one, but shake it an odd number of times, and you'll get another setup in which tails have been flipped to heads and vice versa. And no matter how many operations are carried out in the system, it will always flip-flop, going regularly back and forth between those two states. Scientists call this a break in the symmetry of time, which is why time crystals are called so, because this operation carried out to simulate the system is always the same, and yet the response only comes every other shake. And the Google experiment, they do a set of operations on this chain of spins, and they do exactly the same thing again and again. They do the same thing at the 100 steps, they do at the million step if they go that far, he says. So they subject the system to a series of conditions that have symmetry, and yet the system responds in a manner that breaks the symmetry. It's the same every two periods instead of every period. That's what makes it literally a time crystal. Yep. I mean, it is pretty interesting. It says they're using a chip with 20 qubits to serve as the time crystal. Many more, he says, and has been achieved until now, and then could be achieved with a classical computer. He says that if you use a laptop, it's fairly easy to simulate around 10 qubits. He says they're not quite far enough for me to be able to say it's impossible to do with a classical computer, because there might be a clever way of putting it on a classical computer that I haven't thought of. But I think this is the most convincing experimental demonstration of a time crystal to date. And of course, there are some caveats. Like all quantum computers, Google's processor still suffers from decoherence, which can cause a decay in the qubit's quantum states and means that time crystals' oscillations inevitably die out as the environment interferes with the system. The preprint, however, argues that as the processor becomes more effectively isolated, this issue could be mitigated. I said I was getting rid of the Christmas music. One thing is certain, time crystals won't be sitting in our living rooms anytime soon, because scientists are yet to find a definitive useful application for them. So, I mean, we can do the time crystal thing, but there's absolutely nothing you can do with a time crystal right now. It's not like you can become Doctor Who and, like, go to different periods in time. We're not there yet. It is unlikely, therefore, that Google's experiment was about exploring the business value of time crystals. Rather, it shows what could potentially be another early application of quantum computing, and yet another demonstration of the company's technological prowess in a hotly contested new area of development. It's fascinating, but there's really not a whole lot we can say about it. And we have a little more on quantum computing here. This is another from ZDNet. How BMW is getting ready for the next technology revolution. The automotive giant sees quantum computers delivering value in as soon as 5 years. This is how they're getting ready. Quantum computing may still be at an early stage, but BMW has been quietly ramping up plans for the moment when it reaches maturity. More recently, the company just launched a quantum computing challenge, a call for talent designed to encourage external organizations that come up with solutions that will help the car manufacturer make the best use of quantum technology. It's a search for hidden gems, Oliver Wick, technology scout at BMW Research and Technology, tells ZDNet. It's a clear message to the world that BMW is working on quantum, and if you have innovative algorithms or great hardware, then please come to us and we can check if we could use it for BMW. The challenge, which is run in partnership with Amazon's quantum computing division, AWS Bracket, is targeting corporations as well as startups and academics with a simple pitch. Come up with the quantum solutions to the problems that BMW has identified. Specifically, explains Wick, BMW wants to see four challenges addressed. In the pre-production stage, quantum algorithms could help optimize the configuration of features for the limited number of cards that can be assembled for various tests so that as many tests as possible can be carried out with a minimal amount of resources. Similarly, optimization algorithms could improve sensor placement on vehicles to make sure that the final configurations of sensors can reliably detect obstacles in a different driving scenarios, something that is becoming increasingly important as autonomous driving becomes more common. Candidates have also been invited to submit ideas for the simulation of material deformation during production to predict costly mediums in advance, as well as for the use of quantum machine learning to classify imperfections, cracks, and scratches during automated quality inspection. Participants are required to submit a concept proposal for any of the four challenges, after which a panel of experts will shortlist the most promising ideas. The successful candidates will then have 4 months to build out their solutions on Amazon Bracket before pitching them next December. Winning ideas will earn a contract with BMW to implement their projects and real-life pilots. So you might actually want to try that, folks. We are using the power of the crowd to solve our own problems inside BMW, says Wick. The Quantum Challenge is only the latest development in a strategy that aims to aggressively push the company's quantum readiness. BMW's high-performance computers are currently handling 2,000 tasks a day, ranging from high-end visualizations to crash simulations. But even today's most sophisticated systems are fast reaching their computing limits. Quantum computers, however, could one day carry out computations exponentially faster, meaning that they could resolve problems that classical computers find intractable. For example, the amount of compute power required to optimize vehicle sensor placement has proven to be increasingly challenging for classical algorithms to take on. Quantum algorithms, on the other hand, could come up with solutions in minutes. At BMW's production scale, this could mean huge business value. Wick explains that the potential of quantum computers was identified by the company as early as 2017. A tech report promptly followed to acquire some knowledge about the technology and its key providers before work started on proofs of concept. At this stage, says Wick, the biggest challenge was to find out the business case for quantum computing. We initiated proofs of concept and optimization or scheduling, but those were activities in which no business case was included, says Wick. Initially, everybody came to me asking why we even needed quantum computing. But now, proof of concepts are slowly starting to emerge as business projects. One of the company's first research proposals, for instance, looked at the use of quantum computers to calculate the optimum circuit to be followed by robot sealing welding seams on a vehicle. More recently, BMW unveiled that it has been making progress in designing quantum algorithms for supply chain management, which have been successfully tested on Honeywell's 10-qubit system. So, there's a lot here, and they're talking about the money, of course, and they're going to need better quantum computers. I mean, it goes on a bit, but it also said that Volkswagen was also early in joining the bandwagon and has been expanding its capabilities ever since. The pressure is on not to fall behind in the race for quantum technologies, or so it would seem, and BMW is making it clear that it wants to be in the lead. Very interesting. Microbes turn back the clock as research discovers their potential to reverse aging in the brain. The gut microbiome can be harnessed to reverse age-related brain deterioration and restore cognitive function, researchers report. This is from UCC. Research from APC Microbiome Ireland at the University of College Cork published today in the leading journal, international scientific journal, Nature Aging, introduces a novel approach to reverse aspects of aging-related deterioration in the brain and cognitive function via the microbes in the gut. As our population ages, one of the key global challenges is to develop strategies to maintain healthy brain function. This groundbreaking research opens up a potentially new therapeutic avenue. Well, it should be avenue, but whatever. In the form of microbial-based interventions to slow down brain aging and associated cognitive problems. The work was carried out by researchers in the Brain Gut Microbiota Lab, an APC led by, a bunch of people. There is a growing appreciation of the importance of microbes in the gut on all aspects of physiology and medicine. In this latest mouse study, the author, of course, we're using mice again, the authors show that by transplanting microbes from young into old animals, they can rejuvenate aspects of brain and immune function. Professor John F. Cryan says, previous research published by the APC and other groups intentionally has shown that the gut microbiome plays a key role in aging and the aging process. This new research is a potential game changer, as we have established the microbiome can be harnessed to reverse age-related brain deterioration. We also see evidence of improved learning ability and cognitive function. Although very exciting, Cryan conscious that it's still early days and much more work is needed to see how these findings can be translated in humans. APC Director Professor Paul Ross stated that the research of Professor Cryan and colleagues further demonstrates the importance of gut microbiome in many aspects of health, and particularly across the brain-gut axis, where brain function can be positively influenced. The study opens up possibilities in the future to modulate gut microbiota as a therapeutic target to influence brain health. So that's pretty interesting, guys. They're finding that there is some stuff very early on in our gut microbiome that could affect the way that we age. That's really interesting, because you wouldn't think that the stomach plays a lot of a role in the aging process, you know, or the brain aging process. But now we're finding that maybe what we eat could be more of an issue than what we thought. Like, yeah, you know, I just had a pizza, but I don't know what's in that pizza, and I don't know what that pizza could be doing to my gut microbiome, and I don't know if that could be aging me prematurely or what it could be doing. And even if I look, you know, rather young, I've always been told I look very young for my age, which is kind of quite a compliment. That doesn't mean that I couldn't be aging pretty quickly on the inside, which is a very bad thing. Because I may have a nice, well, you know, a nice looking corpse, but I'll be dead. So, you know, we have to really think about all this. Here's something interesting. Business Insider. Facebook users struggling to reactivate hacked accounts are buying $300 Oculus VR headsets just so they can talk to a customer service rep. Facebook users struggling to get back on into their hacked accounts are buying the company's $300 VR headset and returning them unopened just so they can reactivate their profiles, according to an NPR report. Users told NPR that they struggled to contact Facebook after they were hacked and so couldn't unlock their accounts. After seeing a tip on Reddit, they bought a $300 headset from Oculus, a virtual reality company owned by Facebook. Users need an active Facebook account to use the headset. When the Facebook users contacted Oculus customer support, the company restarted their Facebook accounts, NPR reported. They then sent the unused, unopened gadget straight back to Oculus. I ultimately broke down and bought a $300 Oculus Quest 2, Brandon Sherman told NPR. The only way you can get any customer service is if you prove you've actually purchased something from them. Another Facebook user from Canada told NPR they'd use the same trick. One Facebook user, Jesse Marsala, told NPR that there was no email or phone number to alert Facebook about her hacked account. She then reported her account via Facebook's website. I sent these forms in the morning, noon, and night, multiple times a day, Marsala told the publication. Nobody got back to me, not even once. A company spokesperson told NPR in a statement that Facebook's customer support center is open 24 hours a day to help users with problems. Yeah, right. We also know that we need to keep improving in this area and plan to invest more in the future, they added. Now here's an interesting one. Mm. Neoscope. Not really familiar with this one. How a small neurotech startup beat Elon Musk's Neuralink to human studies. Anything that requires open brain surgery, we should be able to provide a solution for. Last week, the FDA granted the neurotech startup system Synchron a groundbreaking approval to conduct more ambitious experiments and test its neural implant in human paralysis patients, setting it on the path to eventually become the first brain implant to get commercial approval. That puts it ahead of Musk's own neural implant venture, Neuralink, which in spite of over $360 million in funding, nearly over a magnitude more than the amount raised by Synchron, has yet to convince the FDA that it's ready to make the jump from its highly publicized tech demonstrations in animals to the actual human experimentation that Musk claims will allow users to connect their brains to AI and cure their neurological conditions. Synchron's ultimate goal is to snake stents up your jugular vein and into the vasculature that supplies your brain with oxygen, permanently implanting a distributed series of sensors that causes the Stentrode to constantly record your entire brain's activity. Once the Stentrode is in place, CEO and founder Thomas Oxley explained the futurism, it could allow doctors to treat conditions ranging from Parkinson's disease to paralysis, in part by allowing the brain to seamlessly communicate with the computers. Oxley told Futurism that he credits decades of research and the minimally invasive procedures, not quite surgeries, that use stents, balloons, and other small devices to treat cardiovascular conditions for his rapid success with the Stentrode. Synchron relies on the same techniques that have been proven in heart procedures, but outside of stroke treatment has not made a full jump to neurology. The procedure is gruesome to imagine, but it's considerably less invasive than what Neuralink is planned, laser drilling holes through volunteers' skulls and threading them with metal wires. Futurism caught up with Oxley to talk about the new FDA go-ahead to conduct clinical trials and where Synchron can go from here. He says, well, the doors that opened up were around investment. Over the last 2 years, there's been a huge focus on the potential for brain-computer interfaces. It's kind of weird watching how that... Why don't they just call that BCIs? It's kind of weird watching how the neural interface of the brain, or the brain interface, has really made its way into popular culture arena. You know, Black Mirror, Transcendence, Upload, The Feed. Most of them are dystopic. It's like there's this sense of inevitability around the fact that we're going to have electrical connections directly into our brains. But I think the investors see that there is an application for this technology in the medical space that's going to be industry-forming. In terms of the value of this approval, a lot of investors I speak to have trouble with the risk that comes with regulatory and reimbursement approvals for medical devices. Even though they want to get involved in the space, they have trouble understanding that risk. And I guess once we had gotten into the human research days, that sets us apart from the other companies because the other companies hadn't yet done that on their own. He says, I thought I was going to have trouble raising the last round of financing until we got this FDA clearance. But Pulsala Ventures stepped in on the basis of our human data in Australia and we got a great deal done. So we've been able to keep moving forward. The value is around getting through the FDA pathway on track to approval. If you want to summarize what that looks like, it's pretty simple with the FDA. Number one, do a feasibility study. Number two, do a pivotal study. Once you finish your pivotal study, the FDA can give you approval to start selling the device and go to market. The FDA wants companies to do a feasibility study first. You do that, it's a handful of patients to make sure it's safe, make sure it works. That's what we just got approval to do in the US. And then you go into a larger pivotal study. The FDA looks at that, and once that's okay, you've got approval, and then you're first to market. There isn't a trade-off. It's a matter of how small the technology needs to be to get to the degree of brain signal recording that we want. So with the brain system that we have right now, we've chosen a very large blood vessel which has a certain amount of access. But the main distinction I would make between all the different approaches is that ultimately the goal should be whole brain data transfer. And the problem with having to remove skulls, you can't reach the whole brain. You can only reach whatever part of the brain sits directly under the skull. Unless you're going to remove the entire skull, which is not a good idea. We need that, right? I believe that the ultimate endgame for this technology is to have bi-directional data flow to all regions of the brain, and the blood vessels is the only way to achieve that. I don't know if you caught Eddie Chang's work. They got a lot of publicity about a couple weeks ago. They were doing a decoding of speech. I think what was really interesting, the surgery also required removal of skull, but they didn't stick needles into the brain. They just put surface electrodes onto the surface of the brain, which is exactly what we're doing. So the blood vessels basically lie along the surface of the brain, and for me, that study that Eddie Chang did proved that you don't need to inject needles into the brain to get really high quality recording. I don't ultimately believe that there is a trade-off at all with using the blood vessels. The FDA cares about safety. That's their job. And so it's not so much the fact that it's just the blood vessels. It's the fact that we have decades of research to point towards to understand how safe it is to leave things behind in blood vessels. They're called stents, right? Like, we all know about stents. So I think what was important for us to move relatively quickly along with this regulatory process so far with the FDA was that we could say, hey, we know what happens when you leave a device in a blood vessel. So we're going to leverage all that knowledge to justify our safety rationale. And he says, I think what Neuralink is doing is incredible, incredible research. They have an amazing team. They've made a huge amount of headway. They've already had a big impact on space. I guess we're competitors because it's the brain-computer interface field, but it's such a different approach that I think whatever our product can do is going to be with consideration to the fact that patients don't have to have their skull removed. I really think it's going to be a very different experience for the patients, so I don't think we're directly competing. We see an opportunity to help with medical conditions that require whole brain data recording. We're looking towards epilepsy. We're looking towards depression. We're looking towards sleep. We're looking towards movement disorders like tremors and Parkinson's disease. Anything that requires open brain surgery, we should be able to provide a solution for. We broadly see ourselves as offering minimally invasive solutions for all brain interference technology applications. There are several already on the market, and they're growing all the time. It's a very big industry. Right now, the industry for deep brain simulation is primarily around Parkinson's disease and epilepsy. There are certainly areas that we're moving into. And paralysis is our flagship, he says. Our flagship approach in paralysis deals with the problem of not being able to move. If a patient can't move, it means they can't control a digital world. We convert the attempted movements out of the brain to a platform that gives them freedom and independence. So the digitization of the intent is the solution for... paralysis. Now, what is used to control remains to be seen. I mean, we're not building robotic limbs, we're building a control platform. I can say we're working very hard to quantify that metric. They're basically talking about safety. But you know my view is that the industry forms around the selection of that metric by the first mover to the market. That's going to be really important, and so we'll be sharing that at some point when it's appropriate. And so we have a large system that can be delivered into large blood vessels. We need to miniaturize and scale. The blood vessels exist in all regions of the brain. We are building technology to reach them now. So that's kind of interesting. Okay, according to the Star, humans used up the Earth's available renewable resources for the year by July the 29th. Humanity used more ecological resources in 2021 than the Earth could regenerate in a year by July 29th, according to international research organization the Global Footprint Network. Earth Overshoot Day marks the day on which demand for the planet's renewable resources outpaced the rate in which they could regenerate. In Canada, meanwhile, consumption of these resources is moving at a disproportionate rate, one environment expert told the Star. Together, this represents a taxing of the Earth's resources that cannot be regenerated within a one-year time frame. At present, We would need 1.7 Earths to sustain current human activity levels globally. If everyone on Earth were to live like Canadians, Overshoot Day would fall much sooner. On March 14th, just 2.5 months into the year, the Global Footprint Network estimates this date is the same for both the U.S. and Kuwait. Eric Miller, director of the Ecological Footprint Initiative at York University, said that a lot of Earth's surface is needed to sequester the emissions we release in a year. Net zero emissions, a main goal of the Paris Agreement, mean that there must be an equal soaking up of greenhouse gas emissions by either land or ocean, Miller explained. Canada is using a disproportionate amount of the Earth's biocapacity, Miller said, referring to the ability of the planet to rebuild biological resources and absorb waste deposited by humans. While Canada has a small population, consumption is high per person. Any efforts that we make to conserve is very impactful for the rest of the world, he said. Symptoms of overusing the Earth's biological resources include not only climate change, but also deforestation, scarcity of fresh water, and biodiversity loss, explained Mathis Wackernagel, founder and president of Global Footprint Network. They said, "We pay for the present by depleting the future," he said, adding that the strain on resources is similar to that of a pyramid scheme. While early investments seem acceptable, eventually the ramifications will catch up and resources will be depleted. Since the early 1970s, when humanity first went into Overshoot, the date that humanity has depleted its resources has moved faster up on the calendar, according to past data from the Global Footprint Network. This is all about the Global Footprint Network. I don't even know what the fucking Global Footprint Network is. In 1971, that date fell on December the 20th, but by 1986, just 15 years later, Global Overshoot Day fell nearly 2 months earlier on October the 30th. Evolving data and new findings mean that it's difficult to compare each new date against the other, the network warns. That said, the fact that the date creeps up annually is significant. If trends continue and Overshoot moves further up the calendar, it indicates that humans are vastly overusing available resources. On the bright side, the rate at which the date has moved has been slowing. Arguments that certain countries produce more emissions than others shouldn't be a shield from taking action, Wackernagel said. The less others do, the more risk you have. That means you have to prepare yourself for a future that has never been more predictable than what we have right now. Got one here. This one be more crime-tinged. Indiana woman accused of chopping off dad's legs in front of kids. Shit! A woman in Indiana is accused of the gruesome murder of her kid's father. Not only is Thessalonica Allen accused of killing her husband before chopping up his body and putting it in bags, but police said she also asked her two children to help. Oh, excuse me, just a second. It's getting kind of stuffy here. Yeah, I have to use my inhaler, ventilator, whatever this thing is. The vapor inhaler, yeah. Just stuffy. Okay, but it says that she's not only accused of killing her husband before chopping up his body and putting it in the bags, the police said she also asked her two children to help. According to court documents obtained by WSBT, Allen shot her husband, Randy Allen, inside the LaPorte, Indiana apartment last Tuesday. According to investigators, she then cut off his legs, stuffed him into a bag, and had plans to put him in his car and light it on fire. Jesus. This is unbelievable, said neighbor Benjamin Wilson. We never thought something like this would happen in LaPorte. Allen allegedly told police that Randy choked and attacked her. Well, assaulted would be the same, which is why she shot him. The two children who were home at the time told police they heard a loud bang and saw their father laying on the ground, asking them to call 911, but their mother told them not to. Police said she then put his body in her daughter's closet. Damn. Investigators said Allen woke up her kids in the middle of the night and asked them to help carry his body out of the closet and put it in the car. Court documents also show they tried several times, but said he was too heavy. The next day, Allen used an axe to cut off Randy's legs and had her children help put him into a bag and clean up the crime scene. Her husband's family is beside themselves. We're devastated, said Randy's sister, Sharon Coleman. This was a senseless murder that didn't have to happen. When I was told, I just started screaming. I lost it, added Randy's aunt, Patricia Blanton. Can't imagine what the kids are going through. When police searched their apartment along with his body, they found a handwritten to-do list that included things like spray, expletive in face, hit him in knee with a hammer, hit him with a hammer and stab him, roll him up in body sheets and plastic bags. Jesus Christ! You know, dolls don't do that. This is killing me. It's killing me, said the victim's mother, Teresa Tyler. We don't have that kind of stuff in our family. We love each other. We're close. The autopsy found that the bullet entered Randy's spinal cord area, and he was likely not able to move and bled to death. Alan is set to be in court for initial hearing on Friday. Randy's family is also planning a vigil for Friday evening. Jesus. This woman is absolutely fucking crazy. There's a video here, but I'm not going to play the audio. I just want to see if they're going to show what this woman looked like. Because I'm not getting an image of her. Let's see. Oh my God! Lord, that's a German Shepherd! That is a German Shepherd. Brother, you should have ran. And you should have ran fast. And you should have ran so fast that Sonic is in the dust. It's like, I'm going, Sonic. I'm out here. Sonic's like, what the fuck? It's like, it's okay, Sonic. He's run away from his crazy wife. Yeah, that's fucking insane, man. Wow. I can't believe it. Got another one here. Man attempts to cure constipation via an eel in his anus. Nearly dies. After an attempt to cure his constipation by inserting a sizable live eel into his anus, a man from Jinghua in East China's Jiangsu province has lived to regret it. Unfortunately for both eels and anuses alike, this is not an isolated incident. Jesus. The man had become constipated and eschewed using medical advice on relieving constipation, opting for the folk remedy of ramming an eel up there and letting it do its thing. Unfortunately, its thing was to travel up to the rectum and into his colon, where it bit a hole in the colon wall and made its way to the abdomen. The man was in pain, but was too shy to see. Too shy to see the doctor, according to the Global Times. Hold on. After a day, he finally gave in and sought medical help at a local hospital where doctors told him he could have lost his life. The unnamed patient was operated on to remove the 20-centimeter, 8-inch eel. Remarkably, the eel had also survived its adventure, was still alive when surgeons pulled him out. The lesson was not about not putting live eels into your anus, was learned the hard way. This folk remedy has struck others in recent times. 2017, a man had a 50-centimeter eel removed from his stomach following his own attempt to relieve constipation. In 2020, a man in his 50s also inserted an Asian swamp eel into his anus, which also entered his abdominal cavity. Following the injury, feces and pus entered the cavity, giving him a severe infection. Because he inserted a live eel into himself, the chances of him dying were quite high had he not had the surgery in time, his doctor said, adding he inserted it up his anus into his rectum. I suspect it was then that the perforation in his sigmoid colon occurred. Unlike in more recent events, this eel did not survive. Wow. You know, I've had constipation pretty bad lately. And one thing I realize is I tend to sit on the toilet too much. One thing that you may not understand about hemorrhoids, it's very important, is that you get hemorrhoids from sitting on the damn toilet a lot. You can get them really bad. So one thing to do, and I know a lot of people want to take their phones into the bathroom with them while they're on the commode, is kind of mimic, or not mimic, but limit the time that you're using the toilet. Like, it's the straddling. It's that's not very good. And again, you know, you can always use, like, Preparation H or something like that. Because, again, what happens is that the hemorrhoids can get inflamed and swell, and that's what causes the constipation. You know, of course, stool softeners do work, but again, definitely recommend using, you know, some hemorrhoid stuff and limiting the time that you're on the toilet. You know, it may sound like no-brainer, but some people, you know, they like to get on their phone and they're on the toilet, and that's what they do. Just hang out. I remember a whole guy that I worked with. And I mean, a whole guy, dude was pretty big. So a whole guy actually fits. But I remember a dude, he watched whole ass, he was gonna watch whole ass WrestleMania in the bathroom. Like, at work. All of a sudden, you know, I'm in the stall next to him, and it's like, "Hey everyone, and welcome to WrestleMania!" And I'm like, "Holy shit, this motherfucker gonna watch all of WrestleMania on the toilet today?" Because, you know he's got hemorrhoids on top of hemorrhoids. There ain't no shit coming out of there. But I'm serious. We got to talk about this shit because it's important. We talk about mental, man's health. We need to talk about hemorrhoids. Hemorrhoids are important. You need to take care of your bum. That means don't sit on the damn toilet all damn day. That's one thing I've had to learn. One thing a lot of other people are going to have to learn, too. It affects women as well now. You don't want hemorrhoids. Well, you're going to get them if you're constantly straining on that toilet. You constantly on there sitting. You don't do that. Also, look into flushable hemorrhoid wipes. Those work too. Don't use that fucking toilet paper. Toilet paper is real bad. That really scrunchy stuff, you know, that they put in the workplace bathrooms. Don't use that shit. It's all hard, and it's really going to tear your anus and everything. So don't use that shit. You'd be surprised how delicate that skin is in there. And those blood vessels in there are really, really, really sensitive. So the more you fuck with them, the worse they're going to be. The more they're going to swell, and the harder it is going for your bowels to move. So just keep all that in mind. And don't put eels in your ass. Alright, apparently there's a guy calling librarians and masturbating while they read a specific Supreme Court case. What? I understand that there's a great societal push on the posits that theory gender is fluid and merely a social... Okay, hold on. I understand that there's a great societal push on that posits the theory gender is fluid and merely a social construct, and the movement aims to minimize the distinction between us that has traditionally been determined by the sex organs we are born with. And I'm not here to argue that point. Just to point out that men and women are really different is more just a lazy premise for hack comics. And at least one major respect, it remains as true as it has for the dawn of time. Masturbation. Or to be more specific, while everyone does it, unlike women, men will jack it to anything. Literally anything you can think of, some dude out there is capable of pleasuring himself to it. Anything. And from the Facebook page, Library Think Tank, it links to, asking for stories from librarians about weirdos, calling them to ask and to be read to. Ask and I shall deliver. Okay, so the latest drama is apparently there's a man calling random libraries across the country, and he's asking for information on a court case, specifically Brady v. Maryland. And when he calls, he claims he doesn't have a computer, so he asks for the case to be read aloud to him. Here's the thing, he's asking for, not legal reasons, but, because he's, well, he's, you know, and he's called multiple libraries and done this, and the FBI is supposedly involved, and can't catch this pervert that's just calling libraries and getting off on librarians reading about some random court case. And apparently the dude called my work, and I wasn't there for it, but they put him on hold because they were like, is it him? So they got a male coworker to answer the phone, and immediately hung up and, like, what is happening? I talked to him. He is absolutely masturbating while you read the court case. He has hit multiple libraries across the country. He called my library twice and another local library last week. So if you get a block number asking you to read Brady versus Maryland wiki article while he writes it out by hand, hang up, log it, tell your managers. Back to the original article. But here's the thing. It's always Brady v. Maryland. There are actual Supreme Court opinions with pornography discussed in the facts. For the record, according to Brady v. Maryland's Wikipedia page, it's a 1963 decision which held that prosecutors have to hand over all exculpatory evidence. As to how much erotica is actually in there, I'll leave it to the people who have to study that shit so they can get the perps back out on the street. I'm bored to tears having just read the introductory sentence. Landmark legal decisions don't do it for me. I'd probably get aroused by a tape of Brady versus Maryland if Michigan had played the Terps in the late 90s, but the SCOTUS leaves me a little cold. That said, I have no problem believing there's a guy out there getting his rocks off this way because I long ago accepted the fact that men are animals. We are monkeys sitting in trees, never more than a few synapses away from our primitive ape brains. Never more than a few synapses from our primitive ape brains. Away, okay, I don't like the way this guy writes. Away from rubbing one out. And it doesn't take a big red butt presenting itself for inspiration. I remember back in the day, Howard Stern had a woman who sold DVDs of herself and other women popping balloons. Yeah. It's called the Lunars. You guys never heard of those? That's it. There's no nudity. Nothing remotely sexual going on. Just chicks sitting on balloons, squeezing balloons, and putting pins in them. And she said she could not produce them fast enough to keep up with the demand. Another example, I remember an episode of HBO's Real Sex where a phone sex operator said she had a guy ask her to squeeze. And he got off to that after a half dozen or so. Oh, not squeeze, sneeze. Wow. There's folks that get off on sneezing. And that's just one I remember. Don't forget about the Brazilian fart porn that you can find on PeerTube. Yeah, it's on PeerTube. You'll find it. People farting in water and shit. It's the funniest shit ever. And there's actually fart porn on YouTube. Basically, it's supposed to get... People are supposed to get off to it. But it's the most hilarious thing ever, because what they do is they take like a normal fart and they replace the fart sound effect with a really loud, like, like just ridiculously loud fart. And people are supposed to get off on it because they like the sound of an extremely loud fart. It is ridiculous, guys. But anyone who ever is like, and that's just one I remember. I'm assuming the industry no longer exists. No, it exists. But anyone who ever worked on those phone lines probably has stories to make the sleazy sneezer sound like the Dalai Lama. So again, think about this creep show cranking his yank to a woman reading a dry 58-year-old piece of legalese, and tell me there's a woman alive who could do the same. They're getting off on ridiculous period novels with flaxen-haired bohunks and unbuttoned shirts ripping lonely widows' bodices off and fangirl fic written at an 8th grade reading level about introverted women getting tied up and sexually ravaged by weirdo millionaire businessmen. Yes! That is exactly what they get off on. They might be nutting at the word ejaculation or excruciating, but definitely not exculpatory. Librarians of the world, and I'm not just limiting this to the hot librarian archetype as much as I am a fan, be forewarned. If you're getting a call asking you to break out the Brady versus Maryland, hang up immediately and call the police. Or if it's your thing, carry on. But at least charge this whack job $9.99 a minute. You deserve it. Okay, and I think that's going to be it for tonight. I'll have an episode about the Great Reset later where I talk about all that stuff since it's pretty important. But I just wanted to get through some of our older articles and get all that kind of stuff done, all the tech news, and we even had some crime stories. So there's been a lot of stuff today. Anyway, I hope you guys like this, and make sure to check out our sponsor, the Spinning Robot Pussy, at spinningrobotpussy.com. And I will see you guys next time. I'd be the Grimlord, and I'm out. Enjoy the climb.